Well, here we are once again, a little longer time period than I had originally anticipated, but better late than never. So once again, we're sitting here for another one of these little chats that we have from time to time. And the piece I just played was from one of my favorite bands of the 60s and 70s, predominantly. And that particular tune, which is going to be the theme of this discussion of the podcast, was one of the few songs done by that band that was actually written fully by and lead vocaled by their percussionist and vocalist, Jim Capaldi. The song, of course, being the Light Up or Leave Me Alone. And in case you don't know the band, shame on you. The band is Traffic, one of my favorite jazz, pop, rock kind of fusion-y bands that was originally the brainchild of Steve Winwood, who many of you may know from his earlier days as a member of the Spencer Davis Group, actually when he was like 15 years old. And if some of you are still scratching your heads going, what the hell is that boy talking about? I'm talking about the songs I'm a Man and Gimme Some Lovin'. And if you don't know those two songs, you've been under a rock. Which normally one associates with Steve Winwood's vocals and B3 organ playing. But what most folks may or may not be aware of, unless you're a musicology person or a Steve Winwood person or a Traffic person or just a music geek kind of like I am, Steve Winwood is a very underrated, in my personal opinion, guitar player. As well as keyboardist, and you know, he plays just a myriad of instruments. So those are the sort of two mainstays, but he does bass and a bunch of other stuff, as well as write, and has very unique vocal stylings that you just don't hear very often, which is just really cool for me. But after his stint at the Spencer Davis Group, he gets Traffic together, just for a little history lesson, somewhere around 1967, I think, April, but don't quote me on that, and kind of corrals Chris Wood on flute and sax and bass and a bunch of other stuff. All these folks that were in Traffic were all multi-instrumentalists, which was really cool. Dave Mason, predominantly on guitar, but also on vocals and bass and a good writer. And Jim Capaldi, who I just mentioned, was predominantly a co-vocalist, did mostly harmony vocals, but did lead on a couple of tunes and percussion and drums and that sort of thing. And on that particular tune, Steve Winwood is, at least live, is playing a Firebird, which is a guitar he still has to this day, I think. I saw the concert that he did with Clapton not too long ago, a few years ago, back at Madison Square Garden. He still had the Pelham Blue Firebird, which I think is a Firebird 3. Really, really great guitar. I love Firebirds myself. I have several of them, and obviously people like Johnny Winter like them too. Although my biggest surprise, I have to tell you folks that are listening out there, was the first time I got introduced to Howlin' Wolf, the really great blues singer, songwriter. He was one of the few, if not the only, original kind of old school black, blues players who didn't play a Telecaster or a Gibson ES guitar. He had a Fender Firebird that he played predominantly, and it was just like, first time I saw an old video clip of his, I was like, oh my God, that guy's playing a Firebird? A black blues guy on a Firebird? Are you kidding me? I was like, whoa, that's like a cool dilly. So yeah, definitely like Mr. Howlin' Wolf. Chester Burnett, for those of you who don't know his quote-unquote parent given name. Anyway, Traffic was a big deal back in the late 60s. They disbanded briefly in 69 when Steve Winwood joined Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker, formerly of Cream, one of my all-time favorite powerhouse trios, and along with Rick Gretsch from the band family formed Blind Faith, and then after Blind Faith's short stint, he went back to do a solo record. Steve Winwood, that is, went back to do a record, John Bollicorn, and kind of got Traffic back together. And throughout the years, they changed personnel some, although the kind of the big three, if you will, were Winwood, Chris Wood, and Jim Capaldi. When they got back to do stuff from John Bollicorn, and later they corralled Jim Gordon, late of Derek and Dominoes, and Rick Gretsch, late of Blind Faith, and a Ghanist, Ghanist, I don't know how you pronounce him, he's from Ghana, Rebop Kwakuba on congos and timbales and all kind of cool percussion stuff, later to be replaced by David Hood and Roger Hawkins, who were from the Muscle Shoals Sound Studio crew. And kind of been on and off ever since. Did a late reunion with Winwood and Capaldi, kind of revitalized Traffic to do the 90s, some of the 90s Woodstocks, the updated Woodstocks, without Dave Mason. Chris Wood, it unfortunately passed away from, I think, pneumonia, but also, from my understanding, had a pretty pretty problematic issue with drugs. I'm not sure if it was heroin or whatever. And Rebop Kwakuba also died. I can't remember what he died from. So it's difficult, kind of a sad history. But as most of you know, Steve Winwood's gone on to do numerous solo projects. And as I said, did a thing with Clapton at Madison Square Garden. And it's great. If you guys haven't seen that, get the video. It's a great, great concert. And you get to see Steve Winwood doing guitar and a lot of stuff. Steve Winwood also plays with Eric on a lot of his Crossroads Festival deals. And the two of those guys are just great players together. And, you know, Clapton is one of my all-time favorite guitar heroes, like forever and a day. And I really think that Winwood is a hugely underrated guitarist. Most people just associate him with the vocals and writing and Hammond keyboards, but, you know, as if that weren't enough, but he's a whole lot more than that, so check him out. And, you know, you got to love a guy that plays Firebird, and what else can I tell you, you know? And for those of you who don't know, let me give you the quick and dirty history of a Firebird, because I'm a very big devotee of the Firebirds. I joke with folks, although I don't know, you know, this isn't really true. Firebirds to me are sort of Gibson. They're made by Gibson Corporation. They're sort of what I call Gibson's version of a Tele meets Strat, tone-wise. Probably more Stratocaster than Telecaster, but they got a little bit of Tele on it. I was actually playing that piece. I mean, I should have pulled out one of my Firebirds because I have several of them, but I was lazy and picked up the most close instrument to my arm reach, which was a G&L, which most of you know was Leo Fender, after he left Fender, formed back in the day. And I have one of his ASATs, which stands for Alternative Strat, Alternative Tele. So I have the Tele version and was playing that. So it was kind of cool. But if I really wanted to be period correct, I would have gotten one of my Firebirds to do that with. At any rate, excuse me, Gibson came out with Firebirds to me as an answer to sort of the Fender Teles and Strats. And the body looks, the original Firebird is a reverse quote-unquote Firebird because it really looks like a left-handed guy flipped the guitar over to play right-handed. It sort of looks kind of reminiscent of a reverse Jazzmaster body by Fender or Jaguar body by Fender, but the tone doesn't sound a bit like that. I think they originally started out in 1963, if I'm not mistaken, and the Firebirds were Gibson's first through neck. So the neck goes all the way through the body. It's not a bolt-on. It's not a glue-on. So it's pretty substantial. Most of you folks have probably seen the bass version of those, which several folks play. Nikki Six of Motley Crue and 6AM and soon to be, I guess, a solo artist since Crue has announced that they're going on their final farewell tour. Nikki Six has a special edition he calls a Thunderbird, which has the Celtic crosses in it and black, you know, flat black and that kind of stuff. It's a really cool bass. If you guys haven't seen it, check it out. but a lot of other bass players have played more traditional Thunderbirds, including John Entwistle, late of The Who, and just a fabulous bass player. But he's played just about everything with, you know, four and five strings on it, and probably then some. At any rate, it's kind of weird because the Firebirds, the guitar version, as I said, the bass versions are called Thunderbirds. The guitars are Firebirds. And they seem to be one of these kind of weird odd number dillies because they come out in Firebird models 1, 3, 5, and 7. And they vary in terms of the number of pickups they have, whether they have a whammy bar slash vibrola. They have an old school Gibson whammy on them, so to speak. Whether they have silver or gold hardware, or whether they have 1, 2, or 3 pickups on them. Typically, traditionally, they've had mini humbuckers, little teeny ones. But sometimes they have full humbuckers on them, full-sized humbuckers, and P90s. So, you know, and there's a variety of custom shop editions and reissues and that sort of thing, because they were essentially made during the 60s and early 70s. The original ones were, the original ones were reverse headstock with these banjo tuners. The tuners came out of the back of the head, kind of parallel, forming a right angle, if you will, parallel with the floor, forming like a right angle with the headstock, with the reverse headstock. So they look like tuners on a banjo, which is why they were called banjo tuners. Gee, what a shock. Gibson also, for a while, made a non-reverse model, which was the body looking like it was a right-handed guy playing it with regular tuners on it with the non-reverse headstock, and that I think actually had a bolt-on or glue-on neck, a set neck. It did not have a body through neck on them. Those are much rarer, by the way. So if you own one of those, that's a pretty rare piece of equipment. I think they made those through like 65 through 69, maybe. I may have the years a little off. Those were called non-reverse Firebirds. Great, great, great guitar, whatever the configuration is, and they're just really cool. So if you folks ever get you guitar buffs out there, if you ever get a chance to get your hands on one of those things, go check them out. They're really cool. I can't say enough nice about them. And before I get onto the topic, and I realize I'm rambling and giving a lot of trivia tonight, so forgive me, I'm in a trivia mood, and a little sad too, is several weeks ago, one of my guitar heroes, even though not a quote-unquote rock guy or whatever, but certainly just an amazingly fabulous flamenco classical style guitar player, Paco de Lucía, passed away in his 60s and on vacation with his family. I think he had a heart attack, but again, don't quote me on that. Really just a fabulous fabulous guitarist, played since he was like, you know, a young kid, and I think his quote unquote God given name was, or parent given name was something like Francisco Gustavo Sanchez Gomez or something. I mean, had one of those, you know, four or five typical Latin, you know, multi name names, and I'm not making fun of that because, you know, gosh knows, you know, a lot of Mediterranean folks, including, you know, my own heritage group, the Greeks, like to do these, you know, funky-ass, you know, multi-syllabic and multi-family names. So I'm clearly not slamming anybody. But if you get a chance to check some of his work out, it's really amazing. Some of you may already be, if you're familiar with Aldo Meola, who is also one of my favorite guitar heroes, again, not in the rock or blues genre, but certainly in the I would classify Aldo Meola more as a jazz rock Latin fusion kind of guy. Does both acoustic and electric. One of the few guys to play acoustic flamenco style with a pick, kind of like I do. So woohoo, El. Most of you may know him. If you know Aldo Meola, you'll know him through his work with Chick Corea and Return to Forever, which also had Stanley Clarke on bass. What a monster that guy is. And, you know, obviously Chick Corea is no slouch either. And Alan White on drums, just a great jazz rock fusion quartet. Really, really awesome. Go back and check some of their stuff out if you have any inclinations towards that kind of music. It's really just really amazing stuff. At any rate, when Aldo Meola left Return to Forever back in the day and started doing solo recordings, his Elegant Gypsy, I think, album at the time had a song on it called Mediterranean Sundance, and he's doing a duet with Paco de Lucía on that particular piece, and Al's playing the steel string, typically ovations, which I, you know, got to love a guy who plays ovations and Les Pauls, because those are my, you know, two of my big guitars as well. Go Al, right? And he and Paco are trading off licks off that thing, and it's just, I mean, it'll blow your mind. Paco's playing the gut string, you know, classical thing. It's just, check it out. You will freak. I mean, it's like, holy shoes. And especially when you see it's like, you know, 70-something, 70, early mid-70s, I think. It's just amazing. I mean, you just hear that stuff and your jaw just hits the floor. Even if you don't like that kind of music, you cannot listen to that without being impressed. You know, I mean, I'm not a real country guy at all. And, you know, forgive me, country artist. I just, it's not my deal, you know. But, you know, when you hear a really hot or really talented musician, I don't care if they're jazz, country, funk. Oh, that was definitely a misspeak. My apologies to all you funk guys out there. Hard rock, heavy metal, classical, acoustic, I don't care. You know, you hear a hot player who's really talented and artful, I don't really give a flip what style of music they're. You got to appreciate him. I mean, you know, I am not, for example, a fan of the slap bass at all. It drives me nuts, to be honest with you. But go back and listen to Jaco Pastorius. Go listen to Flea, for God's sake, of Red Hot Chili Peppers. And again, not my cup of tea in any way, shape, or form, but the guy's a freaking fabulous musician. So, you know, same thing with Chet Atkins or Roy Clark. You know, there are plenty of really hot players out there, and they'll make you really, in some cases, like Larry Gatton, for God's sake, excuse me for forgetting him. What a fabulous flipping guy that was. Very, very hot telly player. Also played banjo, and you can hear the banjo influence when, if you see any telly stuff he does. Just really awesome stuff. You need to go back and check. If you guys and gals out there don't know about these folks, go back and check them out. Be prepared to wipe the drool off your chin when you hear them. Really, these guys are just, and gals are just the bomb. I mean, just the frickin' bomb. Anyway, I was really sad to hear that Paco had passed, and just a really great player. And so it really kind of made me sad, and I was looking around at some of my old CDs and recordings and stuff, and came across the Traffic thing, and that was kind of how I ended up doing the Traffic stuff. And then one of a former patient of mine, way back in the day, had called me up for some advice on something that was kind of related. And they're trying to help out a friend of theirs, and said, "Hey, you know, sometimes we run across family members, we run across friends, you know, I mean, forget our own kids, but, you know, we run across folks that are not even in our own family, you know, and what are you going to do when you try to help somebody? You know, it's like when we consulted you way back in the day, you know, we were having trouble, you know, with some folks, and we didn't know what to do, and, you know, you helped us out with that stuff, and we got some folks that are, you know, that we really like, that are having issues, and we're trying to help them out, and we just don't know what to do because we don't think they're going to be very open to hearing our feedback. Ergo, my Traffic song, Light Up or Leave Me Alone," which, was not written in that vein for that kind of scenario. It was written more about a romantic scenario, I think, but hey, I'll take what I can get, okay? So what this podcast is really attuned to, other than giving you folks a lot of trivia information that some of you will be rolling your eyes going, "Dude, just shut the heck up and give us the main points, okay?" And some of you folks, your gear geeks out there, will be going, "Woohoo!" You know, those of you suffering from gas, which I suffer from too and have for a long time. Oh, and that's my little dilly for gear acquisition syndrome, GAS. I tried to get them to include that in the latest DSM-5, but for some reason they just didn't really want to do that. Can't figure out that why, but, you know, I mean, trust me, any diehard musician has gas. Let me tell you. So at any rate, I wanted to talk a little bit about what do you do when you see someone having an issue, whether the person is your son, your wife, your daughter, your husband, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your live-in, you know, your best dog's, you know, girlfriend's owner, you know, your neighbors, you know, whatever, you know, your kids, neighbor's kids, or your kids' friends, or whatever, and the parents don't want to see it, or, you know, your cocktail buddy, or your bridge partner, or your business associate, you know, and God forbid it, your boss, right? That's a really tricky dilly to deal with. You know, one has to be extremely careful doing that sort of thing. It too often, you end up doing the thing that most of you will have heard me say before, which is inappropriate boundary crossings. So, it's this kind of delicate balance, sort of this slippery slope, between A, do I say anything, and B, if I do say something, how am I going to say it? How am I going to phrase it? And timing, when am I going to do it? What's the best conditions to do it? And how can I put it, without really stepping on somebody's toes, acting like a total jerk, being perceived as nosy or a know-it-all or a bully or, sticking your nose where it doesn't belong or trying to tell somebody how to be a parent or a friend or a lover or, wife or husband or whatever. And what do you know? And, oh my God, just mind your own business. And, I'm sure there's folks out there that have had this kind of situation happen to them. And it's really, really frustrating because if you really care about somebody, whether that somebody, is your own family, flesh and blood members, or your married family members, or just really good buddies, or folks that you just care about, it's really, 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 really difficult to sit back and let stuff happen. I tell the story to folks that I work with now is, this boundary thing, For those of you who don't know, before I get into the story, let me tell you that if you don't know the term boundary transgression, it's sort of a catch-all phrase that we in the business, in the mental health profession, regardless of our credentials or whatever, use to describe somebody who steps over this sort of personal boundary space, if you will, into areas that are really quote-unquote none of their business, and they should probably shut the heck up and walk on and light up or leave you alone, right? But it's a really sticky wicket, as the British might say, because you have this really, dilemma. And in some cases, it becomes a moral ethical dilemma for you because you love somebody and you want to be a really good friend of them, or you want to be a really good dad or mom or son or daughter or brother-in-law or wife or whatever. You care about them and you want to let them know you care about them and try to help them get out of their, quandary that they're in, their self-defeating, self-destructive behaviors, whether it's drugs or sex or rock and roll or whatever. But you don't want, you got to do it right, and then, there's no guarantee on how the other person's going to take it. Now, so when you cross those boundaries into things that are quote-unquote none of your business, and then folks will ask me, well, how do you know it's none of your business? I've had parents say, well, everything my kid does is my business, Well, no, sorry, that's not right. And I know all you Mediterranean mothers and fathers out there are going to be going, what? Are you kidding me? I don't care if my kid's 40 years old and married with four children. It's always going to be my kid, and that I have the right. No, you don't. Shut the heck up. You're done. Okay, after they're of an adult status, whatever the legal adult status is in your field, country, town, city, whatever, you need to shut the heck up unless you really think you can help out, in something that's very problematic. And you folks have heard me talk about, who owns the problem? Well, the person who's upset owns the problem. So the person who's upset needs to fix the problem within themselves. They don't fix it by trying to manipulate the environment or manipulate somebody else. That's sort of the rule of thumb. However, that rule of thumb gets very blurry when you see another person doing things like rampant sexuality or beating the crap out of their kids or abandoning their kids or neglecting their kids or micromanaging their kids when the kids are basically good or, decent kids, but the parents just have this major control issue dilly going. Or, if you see somebody onto drugs or, spending or hoarding or whatever the issue or issues might be that's actually hurting them and or their loved ones, it's kind of hard to sit back and not say anything. And what I tell folks is, you have to weigh the pros with the cons. That's sort of step number one. And you have to ask yourself, how important is this issue to you to help your friend, neighbor, husband, child, whatever, fill in the blank? And I'm going to talk a little bit about what do you do when it's your family member, whether the family member is biological or whether the family member is a married into family member. A little bit different rules, but kind of similar dealies. And then what do you do when it's really, quote unquote, none of your business? It's, your best friend's kid or your best friend or her husband or his wife or boyfriend or whatever, right? And this kind of leads me into my sort of cutting edge criteria. So number one is, is it really that important? Is what you're going about to confront this person on or suggest or gently, hint, hint, nudge, nudge about, really that important in the grand scheme of things. And my sort of rule of thumb for that is, you know, if it is potentially life-threatening, it is potentially life-damaging, or severely I can't think of the word, I'm having an anomia moment. Now you guys get to see one of my many learning disorders, life-limiting moment. Gosh, geez, Manetti. You have to weigh that in your head. You know, obviously if the person's physical or psychological health are, you know, hugely impacted by what's going on and you feel like you have something that might contribute to them getting better or stop doing the bad stuff they're doing or somebody's doing it, whatever, yeah. And you care enough about them, yeah, that's sort of your number one criteria, right? If it doesn't really matter, you know, to a hill of beans, your issue is you walk into their house and they don't have it as organized or as neat as you'd like, right? And you want to go, oh my God, this house is a pigsty. Or you want to say, gee, you need to clean this stuff up. I'm kind of concerned about germs. And really, you're just being an obsessive compulsive weirdo, you know, which is something I know very well. Oops, did I say that? So, if it's something that really is not an issue, you know, you definitely own the problem. You need to shut the heck up and go home. You don't like it over to your friend's house. It's too messy. Go home. It's not your house. Unless it's filthy, dirty, germ-ridden, yeah, you're going to get botulism or something, right? But we're just, you know, it's like my mom used to go to people's houses, and my mom's very, very, very compulsive, and she'd go over there, and you could see her looking around, oh, my God, and I could see the wheels turning in her head, so to speak, you know, metaphorically, obviously. And then we'd leave there, and she's like, oh, my God, the place is a pigsty. Like, Mom, do you live there? No. Do you sleep there? No. Did you eat anything there? No. And I wouldn't eat anything. Well, then, here's your solution. Don't go back. Oh, my God, how can they live like that? I don't know. And I don't really care because it's not my house, and I'm only go there occasionally to visit. And I can sit on my hands, or I can sit with my, you know, hands in my lap and smile on the sofa and, you know, kind of clear out a place amongst all the, you know, dog toys and children, whatever. And I don't care. And besides, there's more germs in your mouth than they're going to get on your hands from the sofa or petting the dog that needs a bath or whatever. I mean, you know, get over it, okay? It's kind of like I was going to tell you the story, you know, as I've said to some of my folks recently, walked into a grocery store that I shop close to my home and saw this woman with three very little children who was, quote unquote, attempting to quiet the kids down who were extremely boisterous and hyperactive, and she's yelling at them, stop being so hyperactive. I mean, and I'm talking yelling. I'm not talking, gee, could you kids please? I mean, she's screaming and yelling and shaking them and grabbing their arms, and we're talking really little kids. Now, I don't know this woman from Adam, okay, which that's clue number one. Stay the heck away. Not my problem. These folks are not my relatives, my patients, my, you know, blood kin, so to speak, my married kin, they are no relation to me at all. Just as a human entity, I feel bad looking at her doing what I call stupid parenting that's only going to exacerbate her kids. But in the grand scheme of things, except for the noise that she's creating that I'm, you know, getting annoyed at, this is a case where I own the problem. Okay, what she's doing does not directly impact my life in any way, except that I'm a caring human in some instances and want to help this woman and her kids. And I really kind of sit there and kind of went, oh gosh, do I or don't I? Well, obviously I don't, because I just didn't see it as being severe enough, life-limiting enough. There's the criteria. She's not killing the kids. She's not beating the heck out of them with a 2x4 or a rolling pin. She's not, you know, torturing them. She's not stripping their clothes off and, you know, whatever, but she's yanking them around and telling them, stop being hyper. And here's the kicker. This is sort of the coup de grace of this whole thing. She's feeding them sugar cookies. Okay. What's wrong with this picture? Okay. Hyper kids and you're giving them sugar. Are you freaking kidding me? Not only are you a bad parent, you're an idiot parent because you don't know dog squat about nutrition and about sugar. Okay. So don't even get me started. You folks have heard my sugar spiel before, I'm sure. And if you haven't, go back to listen to one of my podcasts on one of the most addictive drugs on the planet, if not the most addictive drug on the planet, which is sugar. That's right. Okay? So here she is, hyper kids, yanking them around, screaming at them in the grocery store, and handing them sugar cookies. So my solution to that was I turned my little butt around and went down the other aisle. I got myself out of earshot. I talked to myself and said, you know what? None of your flipping business. People aren't dying. You don't know them. You know, you'd like to be helpful as a human, but if you go over there and say, excuse me, ma'am, you're probably not going to get met with flowers and smiles and thank yous, okay? You're probably going to, you know, get met with something like, you know, shut up, hippie boy, and keep going, okay? It's none of your flipping business. Who do, you know, who are you anyway? And, you know, I don't need that kind of crap, and she doesn't either. So I left her alone, and I feel bad for her kids, and I feel bad for her, but you know what? She wasn't physically hurting them dramatically. She was certainly dietarily hurting them and setting up for bad learning. But again, not life or death, not potentially just killing whatever, none of my business. So I walked off. And I can't tell you how many times that kind of thing has happened in a public place, people yelling and screaming at their kids or misparenting their kids. And I'm just like shaking my head going, okay, you're an idiot. You should, you know, you should not have kids. Get that thing cut and tied off or cut off or whatever. And don't use that thing again, young man and young woman. So anyway, you know, but who the heck am I to make that statement, right? So I just turn around and walk away. I own the problem. I deal with the problem. I shut the heck up and go down the aisle and la, 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 and think of a cool song from Traffic or, you know, B.B. King or McKinley Morganfield or whomever, right? But if it's somebody that's doing something seriously dangerous, right, let's say the woman, you know, had a frying pan. She was hitting the kids upside the head with the frying pan. That's a different issue, okay? So you first question you ask yourself is, you know, how serious is the, A, do I really care about this person enough? B, do I think I have a close enough relationship to this person that if I approach them in a correct time, in the correct manner, that I increase my chance they might hear me, and they might hear me without seeing me as an interloper or a busybody or a know-it-all or somebody who's trying to put them down or denigrate them or make fun of them or appear holier than thou? Because none of those things are going to get you anywhere good. Okay, so first thing is, A, do I know this person well enough and how they're going to take it? And B, and this is kind of interchangeable, you know, is this a life-threatening, potentially majorly life-limiting, life-harming behavior that I'm seeing? So those are sort of be the two out-of-the-box questions you ask. And probably the first one should be the life-limiting one. And the second one is, okay, now that I've determined it's life-limiting, life-harming, life-ending, whatever, how well do I know this person, right? And then, is this the right time? Timing is uber important, folks. I cannot tell you that enough. I can't emphasize that enough. Timing is very, very, very important, whether you're talking about a music piece or whether you're talking about dropping the bomb or whether you're talking about going to bed on a regular basis or intervening with somebody. You know, timing is very important. The next thing you have to think about is, if you know this person well enough, what's their mood like? And because of how this person generally reacts, ask yourself in your head, okay, I've seen other people confront this person with stuff or come up and ask this person stuff or suggest stuff. And remember, guys and gals, confront doesn't mean beat the crap out of, yell and scream at and accuse and shake your finger. Confront just means facing the issue, facing the problem, facing whatever. It doesn't mean doing it rudely, crudely, and socially unacceptedly, okay? I know that's not a word, but what the heck. So if how has this person responded when other folks have approached this person, and have the other folks been close enough? So can I do a compare and contrast between my perceived relationship with this person? Because remember, folks, perception, while it's reality to the eye of the perceiver, isn't always reality. So ask yourself, how accurate is your perception about your reality, about your relationship? That's kind of a tongue twister and a brain twinder, isn't it? And how accurate is it, and how close are you to the other five or six examples you have in your head where other folks of similar status have approached this person and said, hey, you need to change that stuff, or hey, have you thought about not doing that, or have you thought about starting doing this? So those are all questions you have to ask yourself. This is all going on, of course, in your head in microseconds, right? And what I tell folks is, if you're seeing something, then it's an emergent situation. Somebody's about to, you know, set themselves on fire because they're freebasing cocaine. You know, you don't have the luxury of going, excuse me, you know that, you just go over there and knock the fucking thing out of their hands and go, dude or honey, get a freaking clue, okay? Don't play with matches. You know, only you can prevent face fires, right? Oh, you know, unless it's an emergent situation, if it's something that you see that has potential for emergent situations or life-threatening things down the road, either shortly or, you know, whatever, then you have time to think about it. Step back. have a conversation with yourself. Ask yourself, okay, how am I going to do this? It, you know, A is my relationship, and this is true whether it's with friends or family members, right? A is my relationship. Is it important enough? B, do I have a close enough relationship with this person where I can say something and they won't take me the wrong way, providing I see, say it the right way, okay? And D, time it, okay? So whether it's a family member, whether it's a friend, you got to be more careful, in my personal opinion, and this, you know, this is certainly debatable. In my own opinion, you can sometimes goof up or even transgress boundaries a hair with family members and get away with it better than you can friends or, you know, close acquaintances, whatever. So that's sort of my disclaimer here. But ultimately, if you can maximize your delivery and timing, both are really much more receptive if you do it, quote unquote, right. Okay. So ask yourself, take time out and go through some scenarios in your heads. Write down what you want to say. What are your main key points, right? Oh, I think you need to lay off your kid. You know, you need to stop micromanaging your kid because your kid's basically a decent kid. Now, obviously, if the kid is a, you know, is a klepto, or the kid's, you know, a headbanger, and I don't mean listens to Ozzy, right, or a cutter or whatever, right, and the parent is intervening because the parent is concerned, or the parent's partner, you know, is, you know, sloshing down a fifth of tequila, just tequila at the time. Yeah, I know, my jokes never get any better. Sorry, guys and gals. You know, and you're scared this person's going to, you know, get out and drive their tractor trailer tomorrow half-cocked across the country. You know, again, you got to weigh all those things in your head, but you really have to ask yourself how you're going to say it and how you're going to deliver the message. And so write down the key one or two or three points. Do not make, you know, a hear ye list of, you know, we the people, you know, or chapter one, I am born. You're not writing the great American novel or the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. You want two or three, maybe at the most, bullet point type issues. And really what I would say is if you have more than two issues, save the rest of them for a later date. Pick the one or two really important dillies out and hit them hard and let the other ones go, because otherwise the person's going to see you as nitpicking them and harassing them and criticizing them, even if you're not, and no matter how nicely you say it, particularly if the discussion takes a while and now you and the other person are a little tired, particularly the person who's been kind enough to let you point out the stuff you think's wrong with them, and they're like, okay, I'm done. You know, stop. We need to watch reruns of, you know, I Love Lucy or something, right? So do the pinpoint dillies. Don't go into huge details. You know, time it right. Don't do it when a boatload of other people are around. You know, ask to hang out with the person one day, or during one of your luncheon, you know, get-togethers, or one of your afternoon teas, or, you know, having over dinner with the person. Right? You won't want any other people involved. You don't want to expose this person or persons to his or her colleagues, friends, neighbors, kids, spouses, girlfriends, sons, daughters, whatever. You know, this is a one-on-one dilly with you and the other person, providing you don't think this person is going to get violent, right? And if you do, you probably shouldn't say anything anyway. But, you know, most folks are not going to get violent. They may get, oh my God, and get insulted, and I can't believe you did that, and, you know, storm out or whatever. Which brings me to the next point. Do not do this in a letter. You know, do not do this over the phone. Do not do this Skyping. Do not do this, you know, emailing or texting or any kind of crazy ass stuff. Do this face to face with them if at all possible, right? Face to face is a whole lot better. And if you've just seen one incident of this person's behavior and you think this is a one-time shot, you know, chill your engines till you see it a second or maybe a third time. Because again, the person might have just been tired and upset and cranky or whatever. But if you're seeing a repetition of behaviors and you're really concerned for the person, what the person is doing to himself or herself or their sons, daughters, wives, husbands, girlfriends, whatever. Okay, so time it right. Do it in a time when you're not rushed. Do it at a time when the other person's not rushed, which is why I say invite them over for tea and cookies, or, you know, a dinner or an afternoon tea or brunch or whatever. But if you do it for a brunch or a tea or whatever, do it at your place. Do not, or do it at, you know, whatever. Don't do it at a big public restaurant, right? And if you're scared that they're going to get all crazy on your butt, then maybe you want to do it in a restaurant, but in a corner of a restaurant. But my advice usually to folks is, if you think this person's going to get nuts on you and get all like whatever, you probably don't need to be that person's friend because they're too volatile, in my personal opinion. I mean, I would not have time for that foolishness, but that's just me, okay? You folks have to do what feels right to you. But do it in a quiet place, do it in a private place. Start out very slowly. So as you're delivering the critique, you might want to start out with some disclaimers, you know, like, look, you know, you and I have been friends, or, you know, you and I have been married, or, you know, you've been my cousin-in-law, or you've been my brother, or, you know, I really, you know, however you want to start it off. And your relationship to me is really, really important, and I really value it, and I value you as a person a lot. And it's because of that that I'm wanting to say something to you that you might perceive as being critical. And I'm really not being critical. I'm trying to tell you I'm concerned about some things, and I want to share my concerns with you. And if you want to blow me off after that, that's fine. But as your friend, as your lover, as your husband, wife, kid, mother, whatever, I feel compelled to do this because I really give a flip about you. Make sure the person knows you're doing this out of love, that you're doing this out of care. You are not doing it out of spite. You're not doing it to be a jerk off. You're not doing it to get a one-off position over on them. You're not trying to put them down to make yourself feel good. You're not trying to, you know, because you think you're super mom or super dad or super boyfriend or whatever. You know, you're doing it for their benefit, and you need to say that. You need to say that you care about them enough to risk the relationship because you feel like this is an important enough issue, right? And you'll probably take the person by surprise, and they'll probably get a little defensive, and they'll probably kind of stand back a little bit and kind of look at you like, oh shit, what's coming, right? But, you know, hang in there. And go very slowly, be very explicit about what you're concerned are, and say them very operationally. Don't do any, you're doing it bad, or you're doing it sloppily. You know, try to operationalize your definition without any value stuff in there. So let's say that your issue is that you think that they do too much yelling in the grocery store when they discipline their kid. You know, or they shouldn't slap the crap out of their kid when they're in the grocery store. I'm just making this up, okay? Or they shouldn't, you know, whatever. So, you know, you say, look, I'm not trying to tell you how to raise your kid. I'm not trying to tell you how to treat your husband or wife or boyfriend or your parents or whatever. You know, I know your parents, you know, you get irritated with them, and I know sometimes they're a little whatever. But here's my perception, and that's very important for you to say, my perception, or I perceive it, or my view of this is, right? Because you're not God any more than the rest of us are. You don't know ultimate morality. All you can do is you're sharing your view on this, one person's view on it. So you want to make sure that they understand you're not making a value judgment. You're saying, in my view, you know, your parents really care. Let's say you're talking to a kid about his or her parent, and, you know, the kid's really pissed off at the parents, whatever. And the kid's doing all these stupid things to get back at the parent, like, you know, cutting or getting drunk and driving, and so they'll get in a wreck to piss their parents off or whatever, okay? So you're sitting with a kid. You're sitting with your friend or whatever. Hey, look, I know you're angry at your parents. I know that sometimes you get frustrated with them. And I know that sometimes they don't say things the right way, the way that you'd like to hear them. In my personal opinion, having seen your parents interact with you, I really think your parents give a flip. I just don't think they always know how to approach you, or they don't always approach you in the way that you might want to be approached, or they don't always say things in the way that you'd like to be heard, right? And your person might say, well, yeah, you got that right, or no shit, or whatever, right? So you're empathizing with the person. You understand the person's upset. You understand the person's not doing it because, you know, whatever. They're doing it because they're angry. They're acting out of emotional reasoning. They're doing it, but doing so, they're hurting themselves too. It's a lose-lose situation, right? And so you need to say to this person, you know, I know your parents seem controlling at times, or, you know, your parents seem like jerks at times. My guess is that they really just love you a lot, and they're scared, and they don't know what to do. They don't know how to. They don't know how to approach you. They don't know what to say to you, right? And sometimes people say, "Well, they should just shut up and leave me alone." Well, you know, good parents who love their kids don't just shut up and leave their kids alone. Wives who care about their husbands drinking don't just shut up and let their husband drink, particularly if the husband comes home drunk and it's obvious the guy's been drinking and driving. Particularly if he comes home and beats the crap out of you, or destroys your house, or yells at your, you know, dog or whatever. No, right? But you don't want to have these discussions when your husband's coming in drunk, right? Or when your wife's coming in, you know, with the clothes torn. Hey, I've been on a night with the girls and, you know, went to the strip joint and wrecked your car. Okay. So try to frame it that you understand that, you know, the person is not being, that the person that they're upset with is not being a jerk or a control freak or whatever, right? And honestly, say what you mean. Don't say things that aren't true. If you think that somebody's being a jerk to another person and the person's mad about it, so they're doing, you know, get back at you kind of things, but in doing so, they're hurting themselves as well, you can say to the person, you know what? I get it. You know, your boyfriend's an asshole. You know, your parents are not nice to you sometimes. I get it. Or, you know, your kid is can be a real jerk at times, or your husband's a real jerk, or whatever. You want to empathize with them, but you want to say, but, you know, that person being a jerk is not, you're not going to solve that person being a jerk by going out and getting drunk and wrecking the car. You're not going to solve that problem by going out and having rampant sexuality. You're not going to solve that problem by going out and beating the crap out of people or trying to rape somebody or cut yourself, you know, the guys and gals that cut, you know. You're not going to solve anything with that. You're not going to solve anything by doing these suicide gestures or suicide attempts, if they're real attempts, right? You're not solving anything. You're making the matter worse. And I know you're frustrated, you know what to do. You know, maybe you want to consult a therapist, or maybe you want to talk to your scoutmaster, or maybe you want to talk to your parents, or maybe you want to talk to a marriage counselor or whatever, right? But you want to do it out of love. And I think that's probably the biggest message I can say to anybody that's listening to this podcast. Whether it's a family member or friend, you got to be more careful with friends and close acquaintances than you do with family members. Because like I say, family members will sometimes, you know, there's this like fudge factor. It's like, oh, well, they're family. You kind of have to ignore them. Well, you really don't. But a lot of people have that, what I call stupid misanthropic idea. So sometimes you can get away with fudging it with family members. But you know, you want to be as careful as you can. Make sure it's the right timing, unless it's an emergency. Make sure that it's said with love, that you preface everything by explaining, I'm not trying to slam you, I'm not trying to put you down, I'm not trying to hurt your feelings, I'm not trying to for you to feel angry or rejected or criticized. I'm concerned about you and your husband, you and your boss, you and your kids, you and your parents, whatever the situation is. And state your concern and state what you think that you're concerned about, the behavior you're concerned about. Don't use the words like stupid or dumb or irresponsible. I'm concerned that you seem to overdrink a lot when you get angry with your mom. I'm concerned that you go out and storm out of the house and drive like a maniac. Oh, no, you don't want to say that. Excuse me. See, there's an example. It's easy to do. Drive in a manner that's reckless and could hurt yourself when you get in an argument with your husband. All right, you don't want to say like a maniac out. See, again, you have to be careful. I'm just kind of freewheeling it here. So, again, you can see how easy it is. You know, and I've had years of training of this, and I still screw it up sometimes. So that was a good example of how you can screw it up. Think about it. The other thing I tell people to do is practice. Practice in front of a mirror. Do it as if you're doing a real role play, and you're practicing in front of a mirror like you're practicing giving a speech that you're afraid to give, right? Get a couple of practice under your belts. If you have to, take a little card with you. Make some notes. Go to the mirror. Do some practicing. Practice till you get it down right. Okay? And, you know, I'm not talking about waiting 30 years. You know, it doesn't take 30 years to get it right, but you don't want to go all, you know, half cocked. You also don't want to do it when you're upset or angry. You don't want to do it when you're stoned or intoxicated or sleepy or stressed out or on a time crunch, right? All the things I tell people not to do regardless of the situation. So you time it right, you say it right, you do it when it's just the two of you around so that you're not, you know, involving other people, so that you're not like you're exposing them to the world for the, you know, whatever's they are that they, you know, you do it in a way that says you love them, that you care about them, but I'm really concerned that you're doing something that's going to be harmful for you or your friend, spouse, lover, parents, kid, whatever. Right? I'm concerned you're going to lose your job because you show up drunk at the, you know, the boss three times a week or whatever. Whatever the issue is, right? If that person really is your friend, if that person really is somebody that has a great relationship with you, whether they're your son or daughter or, you know, lover or whatever, and you have an established relationship and they know you care about them, it's going to be difficult for both of you, but I don't think it's going to be impossible. And ultimately, that is my definition of close, quote-unquote, friendship relationship, right? Friends will say things to other friends because they care enough about the friend to risk the relationship. And that's true of husband and wife, lovers, sons, daughters, whatever, right? ultimately, I think, you know, wives, married couples and cohabitating couples and, you know, friends and whatever, all that starts with a close, quote unquote, friendship type relationship. You don't have that bond to begin with. You really don't have a solid, what I call a real relationship, right? And don't confuse what I call friends with acquaintances, right? Friends are people who you can be exactly who you are with, who've known you long enough to overlook your idiosyncrasies or your weird stuff or your bad, what you consider to be your bad points or even what they consider to be your bad points, right? They're your friends anyway. They know about you and they care about you anyway. They don't care, right? Acquaintances are people you go, hey, let's do lunch tomorrow. Or folks sitting next to your cubicle at the office going, yeah, can you, what? How about them Braves, right? Or, oh my God, can you believe, you know, what happened in the White House last night? Yeah, anybody can do that crap. You want people who you are real with, real intimate relationships. That's what we're talking about, right? And every real friendship, every friendship is based on intimacy. And again, remember, intimacy doesn't mean sex. It means you're being honest and open with that person as much as you can because you appreciate that person, you appreciate the relationship, and hopefully they appreciate you in return and they're there to be your equal intimate reflection, you know, complementary relationship, so to speak. And that's true to me whether you're just close buddies, brothers, sisters, friends, lovers, husband, wife, whatever, right? Acquaintances are passing people that you don't, you know, necessarily show all your sides to and don't, you know, tell the truth to all the time. Let's be honest, right? You don't do that with intimate relationships. And we're talking about people really now who are in intimate relationships that you care about because that's why you're doing it, right? You're confronting this person and risking the relationship a little bit because you really care about them. And honestly, if you really care about them and they're really doing something that is potentially life-threatening or majorly life-limiting to themselves or one of their own people that they, family members, or care about or whatever, you are not being a good friend if you keep your mouth shut. You really aren't. A, you're being a chicken shit, no offense. And two, you're not really being an intimate, close, good friend because you're choosing not to say something because you love the relationship more than you love the person. That's not a great thing to do. Now, I'm not saying that we all haven't done that from time to time, right? Every one of us. We're not God. We're not perfect. But in the long run and in the final analysis, if you have an intimate relationship you care enough about, you have to speak the truth, especially if it's about something that's of very, very major, serious concern. You don't like the way they keep their house? Then invite them to your place. You don't like the way they drive? You know, and it's not like, oh my God, they're dangerous. Don't get in the car with them, or you drive, you know? I mean, come on. But, you know, if it's something minor, you don't like the clothes they wear, the way they have their hair cut or whatever, who cares? You know, if they're going out and getting drunk and driving drunk, if they're going out and you using drugs to the point where they're getting addicted, if they're hoarders and, you know, cootie things are, you know, crawling from under their couches or whatever, you know, or they're being like ridiculous, you know, ridiculously punitive to their kids, or kids are being incredibly abusive to their parents and it's, you know, ruining the relationship and the parent, the violence or whatever, that's stuff to intervene with. That's stuff to say, hey, I care enough about you, right? Make a few suggestions. If you have some suggestions on how they can do it better, right, in a way that's very tentative, well, you might want to try this. Have you thought about this, right? Ask them what they've tried. Ask them what success they've had with it, right? Because you may come out with some stuff and they'll say, I've done all that stuff. Well, tell me how you've done it. Because maybe they've just tried it one time and it didn't work and they went, oh, well, and threw their hands up. You know, how do you know they did it right the time they did it, right? Most of us don't do things right the first time we do it. I mean, come on, that's what she said, right? Ba-doom. Okay, so, yeah. So, you know, you got to find out, get the parameters of what they're doing, get them to tell you how they did. Maybe they didn't quite right. Well, I tried to play that chord and I couldn't get it right. Okay, let me see you play. Let me see you try to play the chord. Oh, no wonder you got the wrong fingers. Let me show you a different way that might help you to do that chord better on guitar. I did that the other day with one of my students. It was like, oh, yeah, really? Yeah, you can do this. It's not hard, right? And that's a minor example that obviously, you know, didn't amount to a hill of beans and was easy intervention because it's like, oh gosh, you're making that chord too hard for yourself. Here, let me show you. And I call it cheating. It's not really cheating, but here's an easy way to do it. Come on, you know, get with the program here. Let's give yourself a break, right? And that's kind of the approach I use even with serious problems. So, you know, I'll say to folks, you know, you've been working too hard. Give yourself a break. Or, hey, you know, you've tried really hard to do this. You just haven't approached it exactly the way maybe that you would. Why don't you try it this way and see what happens? make notes. You know, after you have the interaction with the person, if it doesn't go exactly the way you think it ought to go, take some notes and figure out where you messed up. Go back and do it differently the next time if you have a chance to do it the next time. You know, don't do it when you're stressed and pissed off and hurried, you know, yada, 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 all the same stuff I tell everybody. You know, you've got to do it with love. You got to be very specific. Use behavioral terms. Don't use judgmental terms. Don't come across as a Bible-thumping person. And I know there's folks out there who really, you know, think that the Torah or the Quran or the Bible is the, you know, the end-all and be-all. And that's great. If it works for you, that's awesome. I'm not slamming anybody who does that. But you don't want to use that to slam other people with. You just do not. You don't want to use your own philosophy, your own theories on life. Talk about behavioral stuff you can justify. Right? Because if you keep doing, you know, and my bottom line message to folks is, we know that what you're doing isn't working. How do we know it isn't working? Well, you're not getting the results you get. I see you calling me up on the phone crying that you had this huge fight with your husband, or you had this huge fight with your kid, or you had this horrible fight with your parents, and this is not the first time, and oh my God. Well, you know, try something different. Try something different. Here's a suggestion for you. And if you don't have a suggestion for them, point them in the right direction to somebody who might have a suggestion for them, right? And if your suggestion to them is somebody to see somebody like me, don't, you know, it's like, well, you're nuts, dude. You need to see this guy, right? Or this gal. No. You know, maybe you want to consider, have you ever considered talking to your pastor? Have you considered talking to your teacher? Have you considered talking, you know, to your choir director? Have you considered talking to your therapist or your physician, you know, your family physician, your pediatrician, or your mom, or your dad, or what? You know, suggest some stuff. You know, make it very suggestible, not, well, you need to get off your butt and call the doctor now. That doesn't usually go over really well. Or, well, the Bible says, or the Torah says, well, that's real nice, but that really comes across a lot of times as a slam and being judgmental, even though you may mean it in the most benign, supportive, quote-unquote Christian or Muslim or whatever way possible, and you mean it with the best intentions. You don't want to go using those kind of things with folks, particularly if it's a sore subject, because some people will misinterpret it, even though you meant it well. It's a hard thing to do, folks, but if you love somebody and you really care about the relationship, you do it gingerly. You do it specifically. You practice before you get there. You pick a good time, you know, with just you and the other person, and you do it with love, and you're very, very specific, and try some suggestions. You know, and the bottom line is, all you can do is offer guidance and feedback and assistance. And if the other person chooses not to accept it, they have the right to do that, even if they're doing something that's potentially lethal or uber harmful. It's not your life, it's their life. Now, if you have, you know, some sort of legal hold over them, they're your kid, they're your minor son, and, you know, and you're not getting through to them and you think that they're doing life-threatening things, you may have to step it up. You may have to go in there and step it up and say, look, I'm not trying to be a jerk, but I'd rather be perceived by you as a jerk and save your life, potentially save your life, than you do something stupid that you don't live to regret and that I'm having to beat the crap out of myself the rest of my life because I should have done this or that or the other. But again, you always explain what you're doing out of love, not out of punishment. Right? If the person says they perceive it as punishment, explain it to them why it is not punishment, at least in your eyes. But you know what? Ultimately, if they choose to see it as nagging or punishment, they have the right to do it. It's their brain. You can't control it any more than I can. You're not God, neither am I. So give it your best shot. Do it with love. Do it in the perfect time, with as perfect as you can, in the perfect manner as you can, with as calm demeanor as you can. Facts, not moralistic, you know, judgment words, and hopefully they will hear you, you know, and that's all you can do. All you can do is be the best friend, quote unquote, you can, and the rest is up to them, you know, and I know sometimes it's hard to see people going down the wrong path, particularly if they're your friends or they're an adult child or they're your adult parents and you're a kid seeing your parents or whatever. It's hard, but the reality is, in the long run, unless you have some kind of legal hold over that person, you really can't control their behavior. You just really cannot. So give it your best shot. Do it out of love. Do it out of compassion. Make it important and only focus on the stuff that's really, really important, not how they wear their hair or what kind of clothes they wear or where they shop for groceries. Okay. So I hope that's helped folks a little bit. Thanks for listening. Thanks for putting up with my jokes. I hope you learned something cool about music. And go back and check some of those folks out if you haven't, because there's some really undiscovered gems there. And if any of you have any undiscovered gems I need to be listening to, hook me up with them. I'm always open for that. Thanks a lot. I'll get back with you later. Have a good one.